So, this is the most ridiculous talk title that I've ever used, but it's exactly what I'm going to be talking about. This is pretty off the cuff, as I was just finishing my talk now. There are no slides or anything like that. So I'm just going to kind of go, and hopefully I won't end up reading from this too much. So we're talking about experiential technologies for the performance of sociosexual identities. Before we can really talk about that, we need to kind of unpack what this means. So we're going to start at the end with identities. We could take all week talking about identity politics, the politics of identity. That'd be really boring, though, so let's not do that. I just want to bring up kind of a few points about identity and what identity is and how we use it that we're going to need for later on in this talk. So identities are constructed of facets. You don't have a single identity that you present in all occasions. I mean, a lot of this is probably pretty obvious to most of the people here, but you switch who you are depending on the context that you're interacting with. All of those identities are expressed contextually. If you identify as female, you express femininity in different ways in different contexts. It can be really interesting to watch how you express that identity in different contexts. You can have mutually conflicting parts of your identity. You know, maybe you're someone in one context and someone completely different in a very opposite way in another context. Identity is performed. Identities exist at all sorts of different layers in ourselves. Some things like gender or sexual orientation exist relatively deep in ourselves to the point where they may even be biological. But that doesn't matter. Where those identities sit doesn't matter because identities are socially constructed, because identities only exist when you're interacting with other people. When you're sitting in a dark room, you don't have a gender because you're not doing anything with it. You may feel that gender identity, but what you're doing when you feel that gender identity in the dark room is you're calling up the social context in which you'd enact that gender and experiencing that social context by yourself. You're not actually performing the identity, but you're performing it in your head. If you're not calling up that social context, the identity doesn't make any sense. It doesn't exist. So, identity is always performative. You know, no one can tell that you're straight until you perform straightness. So, different contexts have defaults. We have defaults in those contexts, but also if you go out into a restaurant, people expect you to perform a specific set of identities, and they expect you to perform them in a certain kind of way. Now, some of those identities, you know, if you're flying on Southwest, you're apparently expected to perform straight. But if you're, you know, if you walk into a restaurant, certainly if you walk into a restaurant in San Francisco, no one really cares what sexuality you perform. What they care is that you perform the script of restaurant customer. And if you don't perform the right script of restaurant customer, like say you try to perform the German script of restaurant customer in a San Francisco restaurant, everyone gets confused because you're doing the wrong thing. So, that's really interesting because it means that we have these things which exist. They don't exist inside us. They exist out in the shared social context. There are these scripts. We learn these scripts. We communicate these scripts to each other. A lot of what becoming an adult, becoming, you know, a civilized human being is learning and internalizing lots and lots and lots of these scripts and learning how to learn scripts. You know, when you go to another country, a lot of the culture shock that you feel is, oh my God, all of these scripts are different. I just want to go into a fucking restaurant and sit down, but I don't know how to do that here. So, you know, it takes a while to learn and reinternalize a new set of scripts because you've, you know, learned one for 20 years and all of a sudden you're learning another one. This brings up the idea that a lot of that modeling is unconscious. We don't consciously set out to, oh, I'm going to learn a restaurant script now. Well, maybe some of us do, but certainly it's very unlikely that your first set of scripts you learn consciously. You know, your first set of scripts you pick up from your parents, you pick up from the people around you when you're small. Maybe later, you know, if you're going to be going off to Germany, you know, you poke around a bit and say, oh, so what is the German restaurant script? How does this work? I will explicitly learn this. But most script learning is unconscious. Identities can be operative or non-operative. if you are in a place where you're trying to perform an identity that isn't being read, that isn't legible, whether that means your variations of the script aren't being understood, or the facet of your identity that you're trying to express through those scripts isn't something that people are familiar with, that identity isn't operative in that context. One of the problems which comes up when you're trying to change identities is you have to figure out how to make those identities operative in the context that you'd like to perform them in. So how do identities become real? There's this entire construct that we call tradition. Tradition is the thing that is passed down inside a culture. Identities are a big part of what tradition is about. Tradition, among other things, is kind of that collection of scripts. Scripts and traditions and identities acquire this concept that we can call pastness. It's not history exactly, because history is a much more complicated term. History is a constructed text of what we understand previous experiences to have been, but pastness is simply the weight of an identity having been performed many, many times. When conservatives talk about protecting the institution of marriage, what they're actually talking about is protecting the pastness of a specific identity and a specific script for the performance of the institution that we call marriage. So there is actually a thing which is threatened. It's that pastness, and it's the pastness of those scripts. We're replacing those scripts with other scripts. This is another problem that comes up when you want to perform a new identity. If you say, oh, well, you know, today I'm going to do things very differently, even if you can get people to read those, even if everyone, you know, you make it explicit, whatever, everyone understands it, it feels weird because it's like, wait, why am I doing this? This social ritual doesn't feel like it means anything because it doesn't have the pastness that gives it the weight. So let's talk about sexual identity. The way we have sex is all about culture. It's conditioned by what our bodies can do, by what our bodies respond to, and that kind of thing, but it's still basically a cultural artifact. You know, you learned all of the scripts for having sex. You know, some of you found, hey, wait, these scripts that I'm learning, they don't make any sense. I don't want to have sex like this. You know, so there are other components there, but there is this shared cultural knowledge of a sexual identity. Within our frame, you know, sex is an aspect of identity. It's a facet of identity. So really what we're interested in is sociosexual identity. You know, you could argue that all sexual identity is sociosexual. What I want to make it explicit, and I want to kind of expand the frame a bit. There are a lot of things that we don't think about when we think about sexual identity. Sexual identity to most people means like, you know, are you straight? Are you queer? Are you kinky? But that's a really kind of narrow reading there. In the larger field, we can think about class as a sexual identity. Gender, obviously, sexual orientation, dominance or submissiveness. Social authority as separate from dominance or submissiveness. You know, you can be a very socially alpha and yet submissive. You know, sexual culture, queer sexual culture in the kind of European alternative sense, kinky sexual culture is a specific sexual subculture. National contexts, you know, California sexual culture, Viennese sexual culture, Swedish sexual culture, community cultures, you know, sex within the goth community, sex within the Latino community. So there's this whole kind of spread of different facets and different spectrums. And what we think of as a sociosexual identity combines all of those. And all of those, you know, all of those facets combined together are the set of scripts that you perform and the way you perform those scripts. So these are all altered by each other. No tradition survives the contact with any other tradition intact. Traditions are basically just bodies of information. So when you have one condition or one tradition come into contact with another tradition, that contact means that the first tradition learns about the second tradition, which alters the total set of information that's part of that tradition, which alters the scope of things that are conceivable and understandable. They may still be marked as being, no, that's what they do, we don't do that. But now that means that there's a thing that you don't do, whereas previously you just did the thing that you do. There's this concept of path dependency in the evolution of identities and scripts and traditions, which is – it's related to pastness, but it's what we – what we tend to think of when we mean history, you know, it's what history actually is. You know, it's the way you got to where you are. It's how you learned all of those scripts. Because the way you learn the script for class, you know, you can be, you know, two people can be performing upper class, but they can mean something very differently by it in terms of the path dependency by which they got to that performance. If someone is performing upper class because they were born into it and that's all they know, then they have one kind of performance. Someone else can perform the exact same actions when they're trying to class pass, and it means something very different to them and possibly to others, depending on how legibility that path or legible that path is. We can speak about commonalities between identity and commonalities in the performance, but it's important to understand that this is all talking about subjective individual history. You know, you can't say really, I mean, you know, we can construct this concept of a facet of an identity, but that facet, it's not like money. It's not a real abstraction. It's not a concept that actually exists in the world. It's just a name for a commonality of experience. And it's important to remember that, because that kind of – that's the thing that reminds us that, yes, the individual lived experience is what's important here. The personal is the political. So – that's identity. That's the performance of identity and the performance of sociosexual identity. What the hell is experiential technology? So we tend to think of technology as being all of the expensive, glossy stuff that we lust after when we go to Fry's. Experimental technologies. You know, experimental technologies actually works too, but I was talking about experiential technology. That's an entirely different talk. I will actually, it is, we're going to kind of get to that territory too. But, you know, so in addition to saying, oh, well, you know, obviously that projector is a piece of technology. The software that Johannes is using right now is also a piece of technology. So we understand, I mean, you know, the physicists tell us that information is actually physical, but we understand that technology doesn't have to be a physical object, that you can have virtual technology. We understand that protocols can be a form of technology. So if you think about TCP/IP on the internet, all that is a virtual piece of technology that says that this node should talk to this node and follow these scripts of interaction and follow that protocol. So we get that protocol, or we get that technology can be protocol, can be interaction, can be structured interaction. You know, a protocol is just a constrained set of rules. So that sounds a lot like the script for the performance of an identity. The Greek word techne was performing to knowledge applied in the context of doing or making. So it's actually, there's a really interesting shift embedded in there. Kind of around the Industrial Revolution and the start of modernism, technology went from, in the literature, being the thing that you did and your knowledge of understanding that technology. The technology of blacksmithing is not about the hammer and the forge, it's about the knowledge that's sitting in the blacksmith's head. But once you have an iron mill, you know, or once you have a you know, machinery churning out the items, the technology suddenly became the things, the physical bits. This is the actual shift of the alienation of labor, where technology goes from being knowledge to being alienated knowledge, which is the physical process and the physical results. But we can take that broader understanding of technology. We can go back to our pre-modern techne. So we're specifically interested in social performance here. Because we like to mess with things, we want to change social performance. We want to play with it, you know, alter it and reshape it and that kind of thing. Because really, if you're just enacting the same old scripts, that's kind of boring. You know, you're just going to the restaurant. You're not going to the restaurant in Mars. You know, what good is a complex social system if you can't break it? So by experiential technologies, we mean technologies of experience and technologies that act on experience as the object of conscious manipulation. We can do this in an ad hoc way, and we do this kind of all the time when we think, oh, you know, I want to start acting differently. Like, I want to be nicer to people. I'm going to try to change the social script so I enact something which will be culturally recognized as niceness, or I want a class pass, or whatever. But that kind of technological frame implies a kind of a systematizing to how we're making those changes that isn't present in an ad hoc change. It implies a technological standpoint. A specific experiential technology is a tool for interacting with certain kinds of social performances and altering them in certain kinds of ways, and it's a way of thinking about that process of alteration. Like any technology, this can be pretty flexible. A hammer is a piece of technology. You can hit all kinds of things with a hammer, though. So, you know, there aren't necessarily two explicit limits. But there is this idea that, oh, I have a hammer, therefore I can enact hitting. So, experiential technologies for the performance of sociosexual identities. What are the technologies that let us perform and change how we perform those identities? Access identities that aren't usually accessible to us. Create new contexts for the understanding of the performance of identities that we might want to try out. There's maybe half a dozen. I'm sure there's more, but six came to mind. So BDSM, drag, transition, postmodern magical practice, LARP and other games, and social engineering. So I'm going to talk about all of these, but I'm going to concentrate on the last couple because they're probably the least familiar to this audience. Starting with the top, though, BDSM presents a different set of norms for the construction of social identities and their performance. Sometimes it can be relatively constrictive. There's a normativity to BDSM, especially in places that have a large BDSM subculture. If you go on Folsom Street, you could see that normativity last weekend. How many people are there who are performing their sexuality in the same way, which was transgressive 20 years ago, and is now just the reification of an existing set of social norms? That said, it introduces the idea that identity and interaction should and really must be negotiated. It creates this concept of the culture of consent, which, you know, exists in, you know, feminist thinking about sexuality and that kind of thing, and hopefully the larger culture as well. But in BDSM, consent isn't just consent to an act. It's consent to an act that has been specifically negotiated. And a lot of the times, you know, very detailed negotiations about exactly how that act is going to be performed. So BDSM covers a fairly wide range of social identities, of identity facets. Anything, you know, any kind of identity facet that you can sexualize ends up falling under the purview of BDSM. It can be age, it can be class, it can be race, it can be dominance. There's a lot of stuff that can come into the mix here, and a lot of stuff that does come into the mix here. Just look at a copy of the Henke Code and you'll get a nice, you know, itemized list. So a lot of the time it involves the ritualization and the reconstruction of the social script around those aspects of identity, which is kind of interesting from our perspective. BDSM is limited, though. Some people may be playing 24/7, but that's still fairly rare within the BDSM community, and it's explicitly confined to the context of that relationship. There's an understanding in the BDSM world that it's at least somewhat tacky to inflict your BDSM relationship, be it 24/7 or not, on people who haven't chosen to participate in that relationship. Friends may pick up the rituals and the scripts that you've created for that relationship, but in doing so, you're bringing them into that relationship. You know, it's very different. You know, if you're going to a place like at Wicked Grounds that's explicitly accepted being in that, in the context of that relationship, and having your sub drink from the dog bowl on the floor, and, you know, doing that at, like, you know, a restaurant down the street. So that kind of limits the scope of the performance alterations and the script alterations that can occur using BDSM as a transformative technology. Drag is different. Drag doesn't have nearly as limited of a frame. It's explicitly performance. Not that many people think of BDSM unless they're, like, giving a demo in the context of performance. Even in our culture that understands gender as performance as kind of a basic in that subculture as a relatively basic principle, people still don't think about beating people as performance, even though it is. But drag is explicitly performance. A lot of the time there's the performer and the audience. A lot of the time this is this very literal divide. Drag is also rarely about the performance of identities that we might see as natural, though, as kind of native identity. Drag in a gay male context is about this very hyper-inflated femininity that has very little to do with femininity as performed by people who identify as women full-time. It's actually really interesting that male drag for women comes much closer to what we might call native identities. And I think there's a lot in there about kind of misogyny as applied to identity and what you have to do for it to be acceptable to perform femininity as a man versus masculinity as a woman, kind of performing up and down the hierarchy of oppression. But drag is still fundamentally, it's kind of a funhouse mirror for identity, for gender identity. It's a performance of identity, but with the emphasis on the performance rather than the identity. And it's also, again, it's limited. There's a scope of performance. You're not normally expected to live a drag identity all the time, because then it's become something else. Then it's become something more like transition. Drag isn't transition. Transition isn't drag. They share a mostly exclusive focus on gender performance, but transition gets out of that performative frame. It gets out of that context that there's the performer and the audience. Because it's explicit intellectual performance, there is still that frame, but it's not the way we think about it. We don't think about the audience for us going to the store as we're performing the gender identity that we've taken on, because that would be ridiculous and kind of creepy. So this lets you get out of the theater and play for keeps with the sort of unvarnished scripts of social interaction, which aren't necessarily subject to conscious reconstruction by everybody who's interacting with them. As it's usually constructed, transition is sort of a jump between two binary gender identities. There's some scope for playing that. There's increasingly scope for playing with that. But it's supposed to be a relatively static thing. You're not supposed to say, oh, today I feel like X, yesterday I felt like Y, tomorrow I'll feel like Z. That doesn't get recognized as transition, because the reason why transition gets taken seriously as a technology for performing that sociosexual identity is because it accumulates pastness within your own life, because it's path dependent. But at a certain point, you start accumulating pastness in a new performance, and that allows people to take that performance seriously. Just picking up a role and playing with it isn't kind of allowed. It's supposed to be traumatic. So we can see here a set of different ways of looking at sociosexual identity, different technological tools for looking at it, which have a kind of continuum of publicity, the expected social acceptance from entirely private, only explicitly people who are brought into that interaction, to completely public and, socially integrated. Inversely, we can see each category is more and more limited in terms of the norms that you're allowed to present. In BDSM, you can eroticize anything. In transition, it has to be a relatively limited, comprehensible identity that you transition to. Magical practice fits into this in a kind of an interesting way if we're talking about postmodern magic, which is not necessarily taking itself seriously, not necessarily taking the idea of the supernatural as a separate category seriously, but a lot of the time is talking more about changing the way we think, changing our own performance, changing the wiring in our own heads, changing the way we interact with the world. And sometimes this is a place where we see a certain amount of use of gender expression and gender identity and that kind of thing as a tool for ritual performance. I'm going to assume this identity for the purpose of ritual to express a certain kind of shift that I want to cause. So again, this is, you know, a relatively broad scope of identities theoretically. How many of them are actually commonly expressed? I don't know. This isn't my tradition. I'm not speaking from very much personal experience here. But, you know, so there's a limitation in scope, but there's still this idea that there's no limit of performance, that those shifts, the ritual performance may not go out into the world, but the effects of that performance stick with you. So that's kind of an interesting way that we see that frame starting to break down. And we start seeing the thing going out into the world, the thing going out into unvarnished and unrehearsed performance going out a bit further. So LARP is kind of interesting. How many here are familiar with avant-garde Nordic LARP? Okay, so I can see mostly people who I've talked to about it. So there's a bunch of crazy fuckers in Scandinavia, and they started out doing LARP the same as everyone else. You know, in the like late 80s and early 90s, it was a bunch of kids running around in the woods with foam swords, beating each other up and killing monsters and that kind of thing. And then you get the White Wolf stuff, and it's a bunch of kids running around in cities pretending to be vampires, beating each other up. So LARP is live-action role-playing. LARP is basically it's like tabletop role-playing, but instead of just playing a character at a table, you're just playing it out in the world. You're just being that character. You know, you're not – yeah, you know, I'm a wizard. I'm going to go into the woods, and I'm going to throw little balls that are spells at people. So, I mean, I'm making fun, but there is actually a lot of interesting stuff that happens even in the fantasy game world. But at a certain point, the Scandinavians got bored, and they were like, okay, this has been fun, but we want to start playing real games, and we want to start telling real stories now. So the game that I usually use to talk about kind of where the genre has gotten to is actually from 2001, so they've had 10 years to come up with interesting games since this. But in 2001, I don't remember where it was, somewhere in Finland, there was a game called Ground Zero. So Ground Zero was played for 35 players. Everybody spent like a couple of weekends beforehand getting up to speed on the pop culture of the U.S. in 1962, finding vintage costumes, figuring out how all their characters interacted with each other. They had a couple of dinner parties in character. And then they all go down into this basement that's been done up like a bomb shelter. And the game is set in Topeka, Kansas in 1962. You know, and there's the cardboard boxes full of canned food with the labels boiled off stacked against the wall and everything. And they turn on the radio and they start listening to historical radio broadcasts from the Cuban Missile Crisis. And those shade over into recreations, alterations of those broadcasts. And the situation outside gets worse and worse. And then eventually the radio cuts off to static, and the power drops, and they light candles. And then there's this massive earth-shattering boom, because the boxes full of canned goods were actually had a bunch of subwoofers hidden in them. And then they sit in the dark for the next 22 hours and come to terms with the fact that their world has just ended. And a bunch of, you know, and then they find out at the end of the game that, well, the shelter cracked and water leaked in, and they watched each other die of cancer over the next 3 months. And a bunch of relatively apolitical people walked into that basement, and a bunch of anti-nuclear war activists walked out of it. So they started playing real games about real stories and playing for keeps, kind of. So LARP is still play, though. There's this concept of the Luddick Circle in the theory of play. And the Luddick Circle is the thing that you step inside that provides the space for the game. It gives you the alibi for those interactions because you can change whatever you want. It's just play. It's inside the circle. It imposes that limit that says that this isn't real. The changes are only valid within the boundary of the circle, but the circle gives us the alibi for the change. Nordic LARP stretches that circle. It stretches that circle really hard. One of the first things it does by saying that we're going to play this with our real bodies is it stretches the circle by you're actually doing the things that you're doing. You know, you're actually feeling the things that your character is feeling. It's not just kind of over there. They stretch it with deep immersion. Some of the Nordic LARPs will last like 3 or 4 or 5 days, constantly in character the whole time. After maybe 4 hours, you kind of really get in character. After about 12 hours in character, the sort of train of thoughts in your life as a player drops away, and you're just thinking thoughts in the character. You may still be filling in lots of bits and pieces of who that character is from, you know, kind of your world, you know, your life as a player, especially if you're playing in kind of the modern times. You know, you walk up to the bar, what do you order? Well, you either order probably what you'd normally order or the opposite of what you'd normally order, you know, unless you've actually thought about, well, what does this character drink? So, you know, there's still a lot of back and forth, but it gives you that kind of time to let this identity settle. It lets you accumulate a pastness of the identity that you're performing. They stretch the circle sometimes by playing games with really thin characters. You know, there was a game called Delirium, which was about playing the experience of madness. And the characters for that game, you got like, I think, a Polaroid picture with a title on it. So like DJ, that's it. That's your entire character. Play it. So that doesn't give you, that makes that circle really thin. It doesn't give you a lot of alibi to stand on. The experiences that you have with that really thin character are much closer to the experiences that you normally have. Sometimes it does away with the character entirely. The entire genre of alternate reality games grew in large part from the Nordic LARP scene, was heavily influenced by it. So here you get games which can sometimes stretch months, you know, with a much lower interaction pace. You're not in character, you've just accepted some little change in the world. You know, you've created some kind of minimal fiction, and now it's, okay, well, what's my life with that? You know, and it's generally a relatively non-intrusive fiction. You know, maybe you're spending your time interacting with fiction. It's mostly just like on a message board, and then you do a few things in person and that kind of thing. But it's still this sort of deep integration with your life. How would I live if this was true about the world? So there have been a number of games in this community about sex and gender, about relationships and power in a relationship or in a sexual context. It's actually kind of a distinct subculture within the larger avant-garde end of the Nordic LARP community. It's turtles all the way down. So in these games, as in the rest of the Nordic LARP world and the LARP world in general, one of the problems that comes up sometimes is conflicts between the player and the character. For games about gender, you know, it's pretty common that that either everyone or many of the players in the game are going to be doing passing drag. You know, women playing men, vice versa, everyone playing some new constructed gender. These games aren't just run at the drop of the hat, especially games which involve, you know, really pushing people away from their identity. It takes people a while to be able to perform that in a way that's going to kind of maintain a certain level of suspension of disbelief for everyone. So a lot of these games are run with workshops, you know, like up till maybe even 6 full weekends of workshops before a game, as everyone learns to like drop gender performance, switch how they move, switch how they walk, kind of learns the techniques, but also gets comfortable with those to a certain degree and practices the social performances that they're going to be using in the game. Because even if you're just playing with the identity, you still have to be able to sort of play it in a way which is convincing, even if it's just convincing to you and other people who want to believe it. And you need to get comfortable with it. You know, if you're really stretching your identity, that's a big, you know, it's a big jump. So differences still persist between what you can get players to do and what you'd like to do for the game. Especially in games about sex. You know, there's character desire and there's player desire. And it's kind of awkward if your player or if your character wants to sleep with someone that you as a player really don't want to. Some LARPs are played with entirely indexical sex. You know, there's a one-to-one correspondence. You know, all the sex is real. If you want to sleep with someone in the game, you sleep with the player. But it's really easy for that to get break you out of character and become about the players and not about the characters. And it's kind of inconvenient. It's one of the reasons why a lot of the early LARPs didn't really feature sex, didn't really feature love, because they didn't really know how to deal with that. So starting in the late 90s, a friend of mine, Emma Vestlander, started thinking about the idea of playing sex in games. It came up first on MUDs, one of the other kind of contexts for long-term immersive role play. Like tabletop gaming, MUDs and other sort of similar electronic games provide you with the same ludic circle, provide you with this, with a way to prototype these shifts in social interaction, and possibly even more radical shifts in social interaction, because you're not tied to embodiment. You know, you can perform whatever script you want there without any physical limits, but that also kind of makes them less interesting in some ways, because you don't have that embodiment, you don't have that physical kick of I'm doing the thing that I'm doing. It also presents a lot of friction if you want to say, oh, well, we've performed this script on a MUD, now let's perform it in real life out on the street. There's a lot of friction to making that transition. There's been some interesting work in people doing like trans reality performance. Misha Cardenas, who spoke here last year and I think maybe the year before as well, has been doing some work with trans reality performance and specifically trans reality sex between Second Life and MeatSpace. Which is really interesting, and it's a way of starting to bridge that gap, but having that virtuality sort of hanging over your head is still kind of limiting. So, you know, and specifically it's limiting in terms of bleed. So bleed is this idea that the things that the player do affect the things that the character do, the things that the player thinks affects the things that the character thinks, and vice versa. A friend of mine in that same game, Delirium, was playing DJ, and DJ was a way better dancer than she was. And about a month after the game, it was Stockholm Pride, and she was out dancing in some club, and she just kind of found herself thinking, huh, what would DJ do? And just sort of slipped into dancing as that character for half an hour. So, you know, you get these things. These boundaries are messy. They're blurry, intentionally. So MUDs are traditionally game-like to a degree which art LARPs aren't. You can win, you can lose, you can, you know, gain quantified things. You know, they come from the wargaming tradition and the tabletop role-playing tradition and et cetera. So Emma started thinking about how she could perform sex in a quantifiable way that would be legible in this context, which started thinking about rules for the performance of sexual identities in a game scope. As she became more interested in the LARP world, this got pulled over to there because it was really ridiculous that you were more likely to kill someone or die in a game which wasn't about fantasy, which was supposed to be kind of about real-life stories, than you were to have sex or fall in love. This is not really the kind of interaction that we want to encourage. So in the context of LARP, what was needed was a technology of experience to separate the player and the character and let the character have sex when the player didn't. So she came up with this thing called Arzamandi. Arzamandi is a way of role-playing sex between two people in LARP in a way which gives you deep emotional interaction without deep physical interaction. So it concentrates entirely on the hands and the arms and the shoulders and on eye contact. And you can touch someone's hands. You can kind of read their whole body into their hands. You can have, you know, you've got lots of nerve endings to play with. You can have a very intimate experience in a way which is still safe. You know, it's still like, oh, someone is touching my arm. You know, we've agreed that this is a context where we're playing out these experiences at a certain depth. We're playing an adult game. We have, you know, we're playing real happiness and real sadness and real loss and real anger and real fear. Within that ludic contract and within that circle, it's okay to have this kind of touch. It doesn't end up getting the player creeped out. You can have two really violently heterosexual guys, and if they've agreed to the fiction of the game, okay, yeah, we can totally have sex with each other. That's not a problem. This gives us a way of separating player desire from character desire. So that's actually really interesting as a technology of sexual performance. It flips back out into the real world because LARPers like to play with things. So a couple of friends of mine in Stockholm were starting to date. And Elin had been celibate for, like, I don't know, like 5 or 6 years. And it kind of took them a while to get back, you know, it took her a while to be okay actually having sex. You know, this was, you know, she'd been celibate for a few specific reasons and, you know, wanted to get there, but it was going to kind of take a process. But the two of them wanted something that would let them have that kind of intimacy without performing acts that they weren't, you know, that one or the other wasn't really ready for. So they ended up using Arzamandi as a way to get that kind of intimacy outside of the context of a game in a way that everybody was comfortable with. So I played a game this summer in Norway. This was my first LARP. It was called Just a Little Lovin'. It was a 3-day game. It was set over 3 consecutive 4th of July holidays in upstate New York. It was set in 82, 83, and 84 in the gay scene at the start of the AIDS epidemic. It was played with the kind of seriousness and the kind of deep thought that that subject requires. You know, it was not a funny game. It was, we want to experience and understand what happened. We want to explore the feelings of this tragedy. You know, we want to get this piece of history at kind of a deep level. We want to explore the identities that are involved in these stories. It was an amazing, just, I think for a lot of people, deeply transformative experience. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done. I cried more during the game than I did when I buried my father. But there was also a lot of sex in the game, as you'd kind of expect. And so the sex in that game wasn't played with Arzamandi. The sex was played kind of with Arzamandi, but on a negotiated continuum, because one of the things that the game was about, it wasn't just about the fear of death. It was also about friendship and about desire and about playing with that edge between player desire and character desire. And so there was this kind of negotiated continuum for sex. It was all still simulated. You know, actual real sex was off limits in the context of that game because it would break the fiction. But it was okay to kind of get pretty close to it. Within the circle of dykes that I played with in that game, we all basically sat down and agreed before the game, yeah, you know, if we're making out, we're just going to actually make out because it's just going to be way easier. It's going to feel silly and weird to try to simulate that. Anything beyond that, sure. You know, that's kind of where our collective line is. You know, some people were doing BDSM scenes in the game, which were much, much lighter than a real scene would ever be. But yeah, there were little bits of actual pain and little bits of actual restraint there. You know, I mean, so there was kind of a much more indexical play, but in the context where every sex act was explicitly negotiated out of game to give, you know, to preserve that alibi. And it was completely mandated by the collective social contract that, yeah, you could pick whatever level you wanted. And it wasn't a comment on the player, you know, on how good of a player you were to kind of pick something that was more closer to reality, because it was really about the emotions of that sex, not about, you know, the physicality. So what all of this has in common in the LARP world is the idea of playing with rules and the idea that rules are a thing that we can just kind of go and have fun with and do whatever we want with. We don't have to play by existing social rules. We can construct games about the reification of new social rules. You know, it's an understanding that you've got this Ludic circle and inside it, all of these social scripts are malleable. Everything's up for negotiation. Which brings us to social engineering. But first I want to tell the story of another LARP. This is the first LARP that Arzamandi was used in. It was a game that was kind of themed off one of the Ursula Le Guin novels. It was set in this desert world where everyone was living in very constrained social quarters. Everyone was in 4-person group marriages. The understood gender identifiers that were performed were the morning people and the evening people. Physical sex existed, but it was just kind of a medical procedure, you know. So everybody, you know, so all the couples consisted of two, you know, a morning female, an evening female, a morning male, and an evening male. But they were performing the morning and evening gender markers, not the physical sex gender markers. sex within your cohort, like two morning people sleeping together, was unthinkable. You know, morning people sleep with evening people, and that's it. So they played in this context, but it was an explicitly happy fiction. It was a new marriage coming together. And when you've got these four-person, very specific social scripts, it takes a while to negotiate a marriage. You know, these aren't things that just pop up overnight. So this was a lot of work had gone into this marriage, you know, to arrange it, to find a quad that really fit. So it was this huge celebration. So everybody had this experience of playing 4 days, four 18-hour days. They messed with the day-night cycle. It was in a theater. Of playing 4 days of this really happy experience of living outside of gender roles in non-monogamous marriages in very close quarters. So a friend of mine, Andy Nordgren, who some of you know, who's the one who introduced me to this entire crazy LARP thing, played in that game in 2003. And after that game, ended up with a few of the other players. Well, it kind of shifted her understanding of her own gender identity. It shifted the way she explicitly chose to perform relationships. But then she also ended up going with four or five other players and got a one-bedroom apartment in Stockholm. And the five of them lived in that one-bedroom for a number of years. Not a very large one-bedroom. They'd prototyped a set of interactions and social scripts for how to live in that kind of space without feeling constrained. And it's interesting that, I mean, you see this anyway, that if you have two people in a small space, it's awkward, you know, if you're living there all the time. If you have four or five people, it gets much easier because it's not about that single interaction anymore. And there's a kind of a privacy, you know, but there's a ways of prototyping that privacy or just understanding that we can do this thing because we've done it once and we can just keep doing it. So as a result, she basically didn't have to pay rent for quite a while because when you've got five people splitting a one-bedroom, it's cheap, which is nice because Stockholm is not a cheap city. So the after effects of that game constituted a pretty conscious form of social engineering, you know, prototyped in a play context, but then consciously pulled into the real world and, you know, using that context to change the real world. One of the other interesting things that happened in Just a Little Lovin' was because we had these year breaks, it gave us a way to accumulate the pastness of experience without having to live through the time. So one of the things which happened was there was a relationship which started in the second year of the game. You know, it had just started at the second year. And then by the next night, which was the third year, there'd been a year of pastness accumulating in that relationship. So they played a relationship that was kind of like, you know, very well established. And then when the game ended, that relationship kind of didn't. Despite one of the people in the relationship having previously been celibate for 8 years, it became, you know, because this relationship had become established as a thing. And when they kind of got the characters out of the way, they were like, oh, huh. Well, this still kind of works. And this still kind of has a lot of that weight to it. It was actually really interesting because the relationship was played very publicly in the game. But then a lot of the, at least, you know, from my perspective, because I know both of them now, the continuing relationship has also been somewhat public. And it's been really interesting to watch two people who have a really deep and intimate relationship with a lot of weight to it already. Like, oh, so what is your middle name? You know, like doing those basic things that you'd normally kind of get out of the way. So there's this idea that you can even play with the accumulation for pastness. You can play with legibility. You can take all of these things which are problematic about the categories, the ways we generate our social scripts, and they're all mutable. I mean, polyamory is a great example of this, right? It's a context hack for how we construct our relationships, which has now become established enough, at least in a lot of places, that it's created its own social context for how we have relationships, and now it's its own normative identity. Which is kind of a fail in some ways if you want people to actually do the negotiation, but it shows how mutable this stuff is. You know, polyamory is new within living memory easily. You know, I mean, I don't know when the first – when people really started using that name. I'd have to go look at, like, the old Starhawk books and that kind of stuff. But, you know, this is not that old as a construction. You know, we can change everything. So we don't have to wait for the contexts and the cultures that people present to us. The quantified self work that Quinn Norton and some other people have done is really interesting. If you're looking at this, if you want to kind of go play with the scripts you use, because if you're going to change something, you need to understand what you're doing. It's one thing to say, we're going to create a fiction and we're just going to go live in the fiction, and all the scripts that we want to change will be explicit because they'll be talked about in the fiction. But if you want to do it to yourself, first you need to understand what you're doing. Quinn was teaching a class at ITP this past, last fall now, maybe? And she was teaching a class about quantified self and about kind of, you know, using quantified self as a tool for analysis, as a tool for changing how you act in the world. One of the women looked at how she performed femininity in different contexts. So that's a really great way to start coming up with an inventory of the scripts that you use, of the facets of identity that you perform in different contexts, and then saying, oh, okay, I want to change that. And doing that in a kind of a systematic way. And maybe you prototype some of that stuff in games. Maybe you perform it first in limited social contexts, whether it's BDSM or other, you know, drag, passing, whatever. You know, decide that you want to pass, you know, create a concept of drag for social scripts. You know, these are the social scripts that I want to change. I want to change my economic social scripts. So I'm going to go out to some big party in the desert, say, and I'm going to perform social scripts of economic gifting instead of social scripts of economic exchange of value. You can hack all of this stuff. Social engineering as a concept gives us the permission to change the social scripts that we live under. We can perform anything we want. It's all made up. So go out there and hack your world, make agreements, change them, play with everything, play with your reality, play for keeps, fuck who you want. So the question is about why I didn't talk about theater. And that was actually pretty intentional. So even drag, I mean, drag is kind of halfway to theater, right? Drag means more than just theater does. But so theater is safe for the most part. Theater lets us see other identities, but unless you're an actor, and really, unless you're both an actor and a playwright, you don't have agency there. You don't get to change and choose the scripts and the identities that you want to enact. You might see a script and say, oh, that's really cool. I wonder if I could do that in my life. But theater isn't set up to push us in that direction the way all of these other things are. I mean, it is definitely a technology of the performance of identity, but it isn't. There's no agency for the most part, or limited agency. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the experimental theater and improv does kind of get there, but it's still – there's a frame in theater that says that there's the performers and the audience. And it's the same – sort of the same frame with drag, but there's much more of a community integration, that drag identities are integrated socially in a way that experimental theater identities generally aren't. And you get exceptions. I mean, you could say that Andy Warhol was an exception, right? Andy Warhol – was as much a character as a person. He played himself. He played himself very largely. You know, he did experimental theater, and a lot of that experimental theater was about the character of Andy Warhol. But that's really an exception. You know, and so I think there's an essential difference between the difference that makes theater is the fact that there's the proscenium. Even if it's vanished, even if it's improv, even if it's street improv, even if it's performance art, I mean, it stretches towards that. But the proscenium arch is theater's alibi in the same way that the Ludic Circle is LARP's alibi. But the difference is the Ludic Circle has us in it, and yeah. Right. So, I mean, there's clearly other stuff out there, right? This is, I mean, to a certain extent, this is you know, six techniques that make sense. Theater of the oppressed, theater of the sexually oppressed. I mean, you know, these are techniques which have elements of sexuality already embedded in them. Which is kind of why I ended up with that list. But yeah, that's actually really interesting. Well, for LARP, there not always, but almost always, is a concept of a character and a player as separate identities. They're identities which are performed by the same physical body. And the character identity is always only a layer on top of the player identity that highlights some parts of it, changes some parts of it, suppresses other parts. But there is this distinct, I am in character. I am out of character. You know, there's this, it's that idea of character is one of the edges of the circle. That as we step into character, we step across the circle. Now you can play without that, but that means that as you step across the circle, you assume a fiction, you do something, right? There's some act that marks ritually that transition in, you know, from inside to outside, from outside to inside of the circle. And for most games and most LARPs, that's about character. For other stuff, like for BDSM, it's not about character. For you know, for magic, it's not about character, etc. But in the LARP world, it's about character a lot of the time. So the question for the recording was about how techniques are used, like time shifts and waking people up and that kind of thing to intensify experience. I mean, it's something which is done. There's an understood bag of tricks. A lot of it's from like the same kind of stuff that gets used in like psyops camps and prison camps is torture and that kind of thing, because it's about breaking down barriers, you know. And so there's this idea in the community of consent, you know, again, from the BDSM world. You can consent to whatever you want, but you can't do it to somebody if they haven't consented. It's not really okay to spring psyops techniques on people who haven't been sort of warned. They can say, oh, yeah, that's totally not going to work on me, and consent anyway. And, you know, I mean, they're wrong. It will work. But that's fine. But on the other hand, if you set things up with rules that are like safety nets, so one of the things that happened in Delirium was supposed to be using Arzamandi. Delirium as a game was also designed to make the players break the rules that were there to keep them safe. So I don't know if anyone actually had sex, but they came really damn close. They came far beyond the scope of Arzamandi close to actually having sex. And the game was intended to do that. And that there's been an interesting conversation inside the community, which has kind of said, oh, yeah, that's actually not okay. There was a line there, and you are now on the other side of the line. But, yeah, a lot of these manipulative tools in terms of, like, shifting day-night cycles, waking people up, you know, changing the food they eat, changing the context that they're in, changing the clothes that they're wearing, taking away everything that's familiar from the environment around them, all of that stuff is used. And all of that stuff is a core of a lot of these fictions. You know, a lot of the time it isn't intended under the name of manipulation. It's just setting the scene. But it has that effect too. You know, it puts you further into the game. The question was about hypnosis. I don't know of any games that have explicitly used hypnosis as a technique. I would guess that would fall into somewhat complicated territory, because in theory, all of the stuff that you're doing in LARP is stuff that you can choose to put down after the game. It will deeply affect you because you've lived those experiences, but it's understood as a thing that you can just put down. Whereas hypnosis is maybe more questionable as to, you know, what context that has effects in. You know, it's maybe a bit more about changing the player than about changing the character. You know, how do you hypnotize someone's character? So the question was about how you transition from one performance to another performance and how you make that explicit in the world. And, you know, in LARP, yeah, there's a, you know, a lot of the time it'll be like, okay, everyone close your eyes. We're going to count back from 10 to 1. At 1, you know, you'll open your eyes and you'll be in character. So, you know, a lot of the time it's made really ritual explicit. I don't have any other great examples of that kind of stuff. One of the things that you can do if you're trying to make an explicit change within a social circle is just say, okay, well, you know, hey, I've noticed this is the script for such and such in the social circle. What do you say we change it? And you get a kind of a buy-in, and then you make it explicit that this is the rule now for this social circle. So one of the things that the LARP community did outside of any game context at the annual conference, they wanted to stop it getting too exclusive because it's this very Scandinavian kind of communitarian context. So one of the things they said is, okay, if you're going to be sitting around having a conversation, you are required as a rule of the conference to have an empty chair in that circle. And if somebody sits down in that chair, they have to bring another chair in. So there's always an empty chair. And that empty chair represents the invitation to join that circle. So you can kind of say, okay, for this community, we're just going to announce a new rule. And then, you know, maybe it takes a while for people to adapt it. If you have a community of people who are used to adapting new rules for their social behavior, it's easier. But you can kind of just do it by fiat as long as everyone buys in. You know, and it's hard out on the street because how do you reach everyone? But, I mean, that's, you know, if you think about stuff like advertising. Advertising is an attempt to change the script of social performance for a target audience. So the Scandinavian LARP scene in general is quite big. It's actually more kids LARP every month in Denmark than play soccer. But that's like the kids running around in the woods as a sport entertainment for little kids kind of thing. There's maybe 1,500 people playing these kind of games. Like, this is the thin end of the weird art LARP culture in Scandinavia. This isn't a huge culture. There aren't really any games like this that I know of in the US. It's fascinating to think about why that might be. If you're interested in this, come to Helsinki April 11th and 12th of next year for Somokota, which is the annual theory conference of the Nordic LARP scene. It will be an amazing time. And bring it back here and come play these games here and use them as tools. So.